Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Marching On Together podcast. This is episode 7, and this is our match days 3 and 4 Premier League roundup episode. And I'm joined by my usual co-host, Mr. Matthew Mauler. How are you doing, mate?
Hi, buddy. Yeah, I'm good, thanks, mate. Hope all's good with you.
Yeah, all good, thank you. Just about recovered from a quite dull deadline day, which we'll go on to talk about in a minute, but not the excitement we're used to.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't too bad from an Arsenal point of view, but yeah, we didn't have the usual kind of rush, did we, toward the end of the deadline at 11 o'clock. But yeah, I'm sure we'll dissect that and other things amongst this podcast today.
Yeah, definitely. So we've got a couple of our usual segments for ups and downs, a bit of transfer news and some winners and losers, which we're going to talk about. And then at the end, we're going to review some upcoming games for match day 5. Obviously, that's 2 weeks' time because of the international break. So let's go straight into the transfer news. Talk about a couple of deals. We may as well start where we just mentioned then. Mr. Partey for Arsenal. what are your thoughts on that? I was quite shocked that they kind of, not that they did the deal, but you know, it's so last minute and these release clauses can be a bit of a nightmare. So I think Arsenal did very well. What were your thoughts when you saw the rumours and then saw him confirmed?
Well, this kind of rumour has been rumbling on since April. And we've now since learned that it's been kind of 2 years in the making, and the kind of head of scouting, Francis Cagliau, who's now left, he was having discussions with Partey, a couple of summers ago. And so there was obviously interest for both parties to get a deal done at some point. With the Hassan Awar kind of rumours rubbing along as well, and with the kind of COVID-19 financial restrictions, I never thought we were going to do both. At the time, I was kind of leaning more towards Awar, just because he's a different profile of player to what we've got in a creative sense. I feel like, I know we discussed this on WhatsApp, didn't we, during deadline day. But for me, I feel like Arsenal used to stockpile this kind of 8-10 breed of kind of wingers, attacking midfield players. For years, we had so many. And if you actually look at the Arsenal squad now, there is kind of a lack of creativity in that kind of like middle kind of attacking third, you could argue.
So yeah, it's all strikers and wingers, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I heard a great analogy. We're kind of like a horseshoe side where we've got good, kind of like deep lying midfield pivots, you could argue, in Elneny and Xhaka, reliable players. And then you've got the width and you've got Aubameyang up top, but we haven't really got anything in that kind of 8-10 area. So, yeah, I was a bit kind of not gutted when I saw the Awar kind of deal wasn't being pursued in favour of the Partey one, but I think it's a good deal. Like, I think he isn't just a number six, he isn't just a CDM, like he is box to box. I watched some great highlights of him against Liverpool in the Champions League, so now he's world class as far as I'm concerned. I'm happy with the deal. It represents good value, you could argue. 27 years old, £45 million.
Yeah, I like the value as well, actually. I was surprised. Obviously, I know it's a release clause, so you have to, obviously, you only pay what you pay. But if you'd have asked me before the window, obviously not as an Arsenal fan, I've done no research on it, I would have said that his release clause would have been in the 60s. Because obviously, in terms of, I know he starts off as a CDM, doesn't he, in Spain. There's not many better than him in that league, so I thought he'd have had a higher release clause. So I think it's a good age, and he's got a 4-year deal as well, I think, isn't it? Which isn't too bad for a 27-year-old. And his ball-winning stats are huge. Like, how many times he wins the possession back? Nuts.
And his take-ons as well. Like, his ball-winning stats, yeah, like you say, are mental, but also his take-ons. And that kind of reminds me a little bit of Moussa Dembele, who was at Spurs and Fulham. Similar profile player, quite a leggy player, but can travel with the ball. And they're great kind of like counter-pressing. They're quite press-resistant, those sorts of players. So hopefully he'll hit the ground running. But
in terms of physical as well.
Yeah, he's definitely not, you know, he's big in stature, isn't he? And he's got a good engine, good stamina. But in terms of kind of like the way the deal came about, I've seen a lot of criticism in terms of how Arsenal conducted themselves. And, you know, all summer, we were basically saying to Atletico, look, we're aware there's a buyout clause, but given the kind of like the COVID-19 financial implications across world football, would you be willing to accept less? They've just said no. And obviously, they leave themselves liable to deadline day when there's literally no other alternative to losing a player due to having a buyout clause. So I don't really see where any complaints are. From that point of view, you could have gone through the club, but if they're being difficult to negotiate with, you can just bypass them and go to La Liga, can't you? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy how they do buyout clauses over there. It's not the same as we write them up over here. Like, you basically pay the player, don't you? And then they buy themselves out of the contract from La Liga. Rather than, like, over here, you'd still have to be some sort of conversation with the club. But in Spain, yeah, they just go straight to the league, and then the player's free just to do whatever he wants. As long as he passes a medical, he goes. And I can understand why they're annoyed, but that's basically, that's more of the system rather than the club, if that makes sense. Because I did see the statement that they put out.
I don't know how legitimate the photo was, but about 10 o'clock, when I was kind of getting a little bit itchy feet as to whether it was going to be announced or not, there was confirmation from this random Twitter source saying how, you know, Arsenal delegates have now entered La Liga offices. And there's a picture of two chaps walking in with a brown briefcase. And I genuinely didn't think people walked around with 45 mil in a suitcase. So I don't know if that's it or not, but I had a good chuckle to myself when I saw that.
It could just be a big briefcase and there's just a tiny check for 45 million in it that they could carry anyway. But...
Or a massive check.
Yeah, or a huge check that four people have got to present.
Massive.
But I still think that's good business. I think Arsenal lack a little bit of steel maybe at times, or they used to before Arteta. And I think this is only going to help. And he'll probably get the Vieira comparisons because they're both big, strong CDMs that like to run with the ball. And everyone says you haven't had that since he left. So I think it was a good move. And like I said, I like the value. And Atletico, they have to buy someone else from Spain because they've got another 10 days, haven't they? I think they can buy local players. So,
yeah.
But I agree with you. I don't think that's anything Arsenal's fault. Let's move on to another deadline day deal or deals. I don't know how you say his name. I think it's Alexis Telles from Porto, the fullback. And obviously Edison Cavani. They both joined Scum, as they'll be known as, for this segment. Obviously, Cavani's on a free transfer, rumoured to be £200,000 a week. Telles cost around £15 million, I think, which is quite a good price for one of the best left-backs. He's had a year left on his deal, basically told Porto, I'm not signing a new deal. So they kind of got all they could for him. So I think in a vacuum, Telles is a really good signing. And Cavani's a bit of a panic buy, in my opinion. What are your thoughts on these two deals from Man United?
That's got to be maybe the most searched combination of words on Twitter and Google at the moment. Cavani, panic buy. Like, it's panic buy screaming all over it, isn't it? You've got a player... Yeah. I don't know, I can kind of see two sides of this argument. You've got a player who's a free agent. He's not earning a wage. Do you go in for him at the beginning of the summer to integrate him, but pay him his big wages throughout the summer? Or... do you kind of have a gentleman's agreement almost and say, look, we'll pick you up deadline day? I don't know. It just seems a bit strange. You can see why they would maybe leave it to save on wages and see if anything else, any other kind of opportunity arose in terms of a forward player, maybe younger, least expensive. But you can kind of see both approaches why you would do either there. But yeah, for me, it screams panic buy, like you said. What is he, 33 years old?
I read a ridiculous... It's a good move for him, I think.
Yeah, it's a good move for him financially. He's absolutely loving life at the moment, I imagine. But yeah. I saw a stat and it was like the amount of goals scored last season. And someone made, I think it was a journal, Oliver Holt maybe, the Mirror, the Mail, was saying how Man United essentially haven't replaced the goals of Romelu Lukaku. And you look at their goal outputs last season, Lukaku to Cavani. I think Lukaku hit 38 in all competitions. Cavani got 7 maybe in Ligue 1 or... was that in all competitions? I'm not quite too sure. But the kind of void, the vacuum of goals, which Man United have kind of hemorrhaged by getting rid of Lukaku and not properly replacing him, I'd be worried as a United fan. If Cavani doesn't hit the ground running and Rashford or Martial get an injury, I don't know, mate. It's not great, is it? Not good business in that sense.
No, I think what we both said at the start, that it's just panic buy is the only way to talk about this transfer. I think they obviously wanted a forward player. They wanted Sancho. That's no secret. When they couldn't get him, they wanted to get someone in. There's no winger they could... Well, basically, they want to buy Sancho. So they're going to go again next summer. So they didn't want to spend 50 million on another winger or 30, 40 million on a winger and waste the transfer money for next year. So they thought, right, we need a forward player in. Cavani's a free agent. We probably spoke to him at the start of the summer. We can now afford him because we're not spending 200 grand on Sancho a week. So we'll just get him in kind of to make the fans happy after a big loss, which we'll talk about later. But yeah, I think that's a bad one. But I think Telles is a good signing. He's better than Luke Shaw. I don't know if they're going to go to a 5 at the back with Shaw left centre back to stop conceding so many goals. But overall, for them to still not sign another centre back and to not sign a CDM to replace Matic, who is getting on a bit, I just find the structure of their business, which we'll talk about later in terms of which clubs have done well, but I think the structure of these signings are a little bit weird. I think there's other areas they've struggled.
There's no sort of like common thread in terms of the recruitment and the profile of player. It seems very sort of, you could argue, reactive as opposed to proactive. And I think Gary Neville summed up the Cavani transfer, just to quickly allude back to that, where it had shades of Falcao, where he's got this sort of European kind of prestige about him, but is he beyond it? Is he going to adapt to the Premier League straight away? And it feels like these sort of signings, these sort of choices made by, you know, Ed Woodward and the recruitment team at United, they're not well thought through, and they have no sort of kind of idea of how they're going to fit into the current system. And I think I saw a great shout by somebody, and I'm aware we've been going on about United, the varying fortunes of them, for a while now on a Leeds podcast. But just to quickly say that, you know, I think it was a media, who was it? Forgetting all the journo's names today, but someone made a great shout saying the best signing Man United could have gone for was from Ajax, and it was Edwin van der Sar, you know, getting an established director of football who's got the contacts, who knows the club. And you kind of couldn't really argue with that. They're crying out for someone to kind of like implement a long-term transfer strategy as opposed to what we've been seeing at the club for the last 5 to 8 years.
And the fans love him, which always helps when you've got fans turning on you as a board of directors as well.
Yeah.
So I agree. They did also sign Diallo from Atalanta, who I haven't seen play enough to comment. And Palestri, who Diego Forlan said is the next Diego Forlan, which I found quite funny. They're forward players, but they're very young, so I'm not sure on the impact on the first team. But let's move away from the old scum. Let's talk about Everton. Everton signed two players again on deadline day. They signed Godfrey from Norwich. And me and a couple of Leeds fans differed on this opinion. I said he was a great signing. They said he was a poor signing. They also signed Olsen on loan, a goalkeeper. He's a Sweden number one. And Pickford's obviously had some more mistakes recently again. And I know they're top of the league, absolute flying, but he's still conceded two suspect goals this year alone. So I wonder if Olsen is going to go straight in as number one. And I think Godfrey might go straight in to start a centre-back alongside Keane eventually. I'm not sure Mina is a good option long-term for Everton. So I quite like both those deals. Do you have any thoughts on if they're both good deals or if you think Olsen's more of a backup?
The keeper screams short-term. It's a year-long loan, isn't it, from Roma, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah.
For me, full season,
no option to buy either.
Yeah, that's a short-term, buck your ideas up, Pickford, sort of threatening statement by Ancelotti, isn't it? It seems. But in terms of the Godfrey one, how much money did he go for, mate?
I believe it was nearly 30 million.
Because Everton's spend is 65 million, according to that stat we share with each other. Half of that budget going on here. Look at the other business they've done. Surely that can't.
Yeah, so it's 20 million that could rise to 25.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like it represents good value. How old is Godfrey? I forget.
Yeah, he's only 21.
He's, isn't he? Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it, you know, it could represent good value. And it's one of those things, if Everton have a decent season, I'm sure his value will only go up if he contributes to that in some way. But yeah, I think they're sensible, astute signings, both of them.
Yeah, I think Olsen might even go in as number one if he can displace Pickford in a cup game or something. Another late signing was Fofana, who signed for Leicester. I didn't write down where from. I don't know if you know off the top of your head.
He's from St. He's from where William Saliba was from, their best season.
Yeah, and that fee wasn't that in around 20-odd million as well?
Yeah, for a player that, admittedly, I've never heard of. I haven't even recruited him on Pez or a Valencia or a Nice or someone like that.
Yeah, five-year deal, fee that could rise to £30 million. I know West Ham offered 20 million and he turned them down, which is quite funny, like everyone else. I think it's a good deal for Leicester without knowing enough about the player because I trust Leicester's recruitment strategy. I think they've proven time and time again now that they can recruit well and sell on for more money. And this is quite a big transfer for them in terms of initial spend. But he's only young. So they're obviously thinking of another one they can sell on here. And basically, I can never pronounce his name, but the other centre-back looks like Lord Farquaad.
Is it Talas Suyunyu or something, isn't it?
Yeah, I think because he played so well last season, he's going to be a Maguire where either this January, if there is a January window, or next summer. I think they'll look to move him on. And I think they always want one standout centre-half at least, and then they kind of put whoever next to him. So I think that's clever business for Leicester. Then the last incoming we want to talk about is a Leeds one, because obviously we're on a Leeds podcast. So Mr. Rafinha signing from Rennes to Leeds for just under £16 million, with another £6 million on top of add-ons. I don't know if you know much about the player, but I'd watched him play twice before against PSG, as you do. He's very good. Basically, he's one of the most creative wingers in league last year. I know it's a different level to the Premier League, but he's a very typical Bielsa player, and he gets compared to Mahrez a lot, which is quite nice. And you can see the style when he plays. What do you think about that deal? And do you think it's good for Leeds to add another winger? Because we really only have three in the squad.
Yeah, there was kind of the last couple of weeks, we were hearing a lot, weren't we, about Leeds' kind of pursuit of this. Is it Daniel Coussance? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, and then he failed.
And then obviously the Dan James rumours were kind of like in the background as well. Yeah, I've got to admit, buddy, I don't know too much about this Rafinha, but he comes with a level of kind of like a reputation which commands a £20 million or euro fee, whatever it was. I have done a quick YouTube highlight reel to kind of know 100% about, you know, of everything about the player. A quick 2-minute video. Yeah, I can see the sort of the similarities there with Riyad Mahrez kind of cutting in, and he looks like a lightweight. I can also see a similarity there with Nicola Pepe, maybe as well.
Yeah, same just kind a smaller version almost.
Yeah, a bit smaller, a bit slighter, but yeah. Hopefully he hits the ground running, but it wouldn't surprise me given the kind of style of play that's kind of prevalent throughout Ligue 1 and stuff. It takes a while to adapt to the, you know, to the Premier League, but also to the Bielsa way as well. Obviously, you mentioned previously on this podcast how demanding it is to kind of like play in his system. So I'm not sure how much we'll see of him within the next month or so. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think, well, before this season, sign-ins were always given a month, 2-3 months to bed in. And it was a bit of an annoyance for some Leeds fans that you'd spend X amount on a player and they'd be on the bench for 6 weeks. He kind of has fought back on that a little bit, and he started Koch and Rodrigo as soon as they came in. But I think the way that we're playing, Helder Costa and Jack Harrison, they're playing really well. So I agree. I think he's going to be a bench player. And Bielsa always likes a winger off the bench the last 30 minutes that can change a game. And I think that's what we're going to use him for initially. And I think long-term, he'll probably start on the right-hand side whenever he's bedded in. But as a Leeds fan, I was very happy with that signing. We still need a number eight. And we're still after Todd Cantwell, apparently, from Norwich, because we've got another 9 days to do that deal. So we'll have to see. And the last kind of transfer news, not ingoings, this is more of an outgoing one that you wanted to talk about. Mr. Jack Wiltshire and Mr. Danny Welbeck. I think I don't know if he's been released or if he's been told he can leave on a free, but he's been told by obviously Watford that he can go. Jack Wiltshire's mutually terminated his contract with West Ham, so he's a complete free agent. And I think it was 2 years ago or 4 years ago, no, maybe 4 years ago, they were both in the England squad together and now they are free agents. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, just another quick kind of throwback. And what was it? In 2013 or 14, whenever it was. Or was it? No, 2010, sorry, apologies, 2010. Who would have thought that Jack Wiltshire and Mario Götze, I know Götze has since signed for PSV, but who would have thought at the ages of 28 they both would have been free agents?
Absolutely, it's crazy, isn't it?
Absolutely mental. But I think both just worth a quick mention, Welbeck and Wiltshire. Obviously, either move hasn't gone very well for them. They both struggle with injuries. You get the feeling with Danny Welbeck, he'll probably end up at Fulham on a free, obviously. Or maybe if he wants to head back north, someone like Burnley. You know, they haven't spent any money this window. They're obviously financially really struggling in terms of kind of like finding the funds to purchase players. So you could kind of see a potential link there. In terms of Wiltshire, you know, chatted to a few people about him and his conditioning at the moment seems to be good. Apparently, one of the reasons why he wasn't playing at West Ham was to do with performance-related bonuses from appearances. So they basically just cut their ties with him, decided to do that a while ago, I believe. I don't know why you'd leave it until deadline day to announce some sort of...
Yeah, that's harsh, I think.
Bit of a strange decision from them. But, yeah, I could see him maybe taking a step down. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on this. Is there anyone in the Championship that you could see a Jack Wilshere kind of like fitting into and getting a run of games?
Well, one in terms of fit, but another one for location. So I think QPR has been mentioned because he obviously does live in London. And I think that they're probably the only London-based side or near London that would sign him. So I don't think Brentford, he fits their age model and wage structure. QPR also have spent a lot of money on wages at times, so which you'll need to. And the other one was Bournemouth. Obviously had a successful loan spell there, didn't he? Apparently really enjoyed his time at the club. They are struggling because they've got a lot of players on big money already, but they've also got the parachute payments. So for 1 year, they can basically spend really high and then worry about it later. So I think they could afford him, and he would kind of sit well with their midfield three. And like I said, he knows the club.
Yeah, so
they would be my only two that jump out. Obviously, any relegated side like Watford as well could have a go. But I think they've got Tom Cleverley, who's allegedly on 80 grand a week. So I don't know if you want to add Jack Wilshere next to Tom Cleverley. But
did you see him
jumped out?
Did you see him maybe turning up at Fulham under Scotty Parker?
Yeah, I don't know what he'd prefer. Obviously, Premier League, he's probably on average going to get more wage. I don't know how much of a factor that is, but if I was him, I'd want to play more. And I think if he dropped down a step, like you said, he'll play a lot, which is key for him. Obviously, I don't know him, but I think that would be key for him. But yeah, Fulham are probably the only Premier League side outside of Burnley, just because, like we said, that they need players, that I could see him going to. I saw a couple of Leeds fans mention us having a go at him, and that's just not going to happen. We've got too many injury-prone midfielders as it is, and he's not blessed with health. But yeah, Fulham or Burnley, the only two Premier League sides I could really see having a go. Interesting to see where both of them land up. I think they could be nice little free additions for anyone in the Championship, and they could be a cheap risk for anyone in the Premiership.
Yeah, I think so. I think also, just mentioning Fulham there, I could also see Danny Welbeck staying in London potentially and linking up with, you know, Fulham on a free transfer as well. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happened with those two, you're right. And I just hope for both their sakes that they kind of get a run of games and they stay fit, because on their day, you know, mentioned the England kind of like caps between them, and you know, Welbeck's got a pretty impressive goal scoring record for England as well. But you just hope that they recapture some sort of form and consistency at some point. Yeah,
I think Fulham is a good shout for either with the wages they like to pay players. Cool. Well, let's move on to our next topic. We're just going to talk about winners and losers of the transfer market. Before we do our winners and losers, just a little bit of chat on the spending. So Matt shared a graph of me earlier, the top spenders, and obviously all the way through to how much each club spent. And Burnley have spent no money, which is something me and you spoke about on our first podcast ever together, saying they'll start signing players soon. Little did we know they wouldn't spend any money. We were both wrong, which quite shocked me. And West Brom and Fulham as well only spent 23 and 27 million as newly promoted teams. That shocked me a lot. Did anything else stand out for you in the graph we shared about the spending?
Yeah, I've picked out a few kind of figures which I thought was a bit... Yeah, they definitely jumped out. So the first of all was Man United, apparently only spending in this window, I think it's because of the structure of the Diallo deal, the chap from Atlanta, 54 million, which by their lavish standards is pretty low. Obviously, the Cavani deal will be quite heavily salary related and stuff. But that was
Diallo is January, isn't it? I believe they don't pay a fee until January.
That's it. So they spend 20 million in January, then there's potential 20 million add-ons. Really strange deal. How that's structured as well. But the other one for me was a club that we've kind of grown to kind of like chuckle over the last couple of podcasts is West Ham. You know, they've only managed, not for want of trying, only managed to spend 20 million because...
Yeah, they wanted to spend West a lot more, didn't they?
Yeah, but they were the kind of underspending, you could argue, possibly. And then I did allude to it earlier on, but yeah, the Everton spending at 65 million, for me, that they've done well. They're spending, they've got a lot for their money. And then just one final kind of shout was the fact that Wolves and Leeds have both spent, you know, plus 80 million. So, you know, ahead of that fixture in a week or so's time. That'll be quite, you know, interesting to see how both teams fare, having spent, you know, a similar amount of money this window.
Yeah, and I won't spoil my winners and losers, but I haven't got Wolves on either list. But I was on another podcast and they were talking about Wolves being losers because they've spent a lot of money, but they've spent it on risky signings, like that 18-year-old for 40-odd million, which obviously we spoke about before, so we won't go into too much detail. But the way they've spent their money on more high-profile, high-risk players compared to Leeds that are more solid, older internationals. Just interesting to see how the two clubs have done their business. But yeah, those numbers jumped out to me as well. And then another number, which I haven't shared with you, actually. So net spend in Europe, which is obviously how much each league has sold their players and bought players for. The Premier League sit top, which won't shock you. 817 million net spend when you take in sales as well. The next highest league is Ligue 1 in France with 50 million. So the Premiership has spent 775 million more than any other league in total in this window, which just says a lot for me about, well, A, about the state of football across the world with COVID, but also in terms of just how much money and how much wage I think players command over here, that they almost, foreign players want to come here for extra money and English players get sold for more than their market value. So those numbers just jumped out to me. And in terms of last year, we spent about the same. So it was about 1.4 billion last year, 1.3 billion this year. But Premier League players only sold for 350 million this year, whereas they sold for 900 last year. So whether that shows that players don't want to leave the league or we're not producing as much talent, what are your thoughts? Do you think it's more of a lack of talent coming from this league and we're having to buy it elsewhere? Or you just think it's just people don't want to leave because the wage is so big?
It's an interesting stat, mate. I didn't, yeah, you curveball me with that one. That's a, no, it's a good bit of information.
Whereas Germany, obviously, they've sold way more than ever before, but obviously a lot, two of them are to Chelsea. So it's like, that skews the numbers a little bit. But just as a different example, the Premier League just not recruiting hardly anything in player sales anymore.
Yeah, I think Arsenal, amongst other clubs, are guilty of that, not kind of getting a decent kind of sell-on value for a lot of players.
Man United,
Chelsea are very good at it, but they're probably the exception, not the rule in the Premier League. But I'm not sure how this bodes in terms of Brexit, you know, this kind of massive gulf in spending between the continent and ourselves. I think you hit the nail on the head there, mate. I think it's more to do with how there's a premium on English players. And I don't think we've started to see it a bit over the last 5 years or so. But we haven't seen that many English players go abroad, especially at the height of their powers. They're usually kind of toward the end of their career to get a taste of the Amalfi Coast or somewhere like that, you know. But it's an interesting stat. But I, to be honest, mate, I can't actually remember where you were originally going with that stat.
Yeah, I just thought it was just crazy how much more that they'd spent in any other league, and the fact we've hardly sold any players for any money. But I agree with you. I think a lot of it's based upon the wages in this league and the fact that we don't sell our players from the Premier League for good amounts of money.
Also be to do with the Premier League TV money. It may also be to do with the fact that, you know, at the moment, Premier League clubs aren't quite as desperate to sell, and maybe European clubs are. It may be due to the fact that, you know, we're kind of waiting for the economic landscape to solidify a little bit before we kind of look to ship off Premier League players next year, once we kind of can see a little bit of kind of security almost in that. Maybe there's a few reasons for it, buddy. But yeah, massive stat. Big stat.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. And this is obviously not related at all, but when firing up the new FIFA and going on Ultimate Team, I noticed how many stars from other countries that you'd normally sign, like the Werners, the Semedos, obviously Havertz, Ziyech as well. Obviously, that's Chelsea. Cavani, players like that you'd normally want to sign on, like, on a game like that, they all already play in the Premier League now. That just jumped out to me as a bit of a big stat. But let's move on to our winners and losers then of the transfer market. Do you want to kick us off with one of your winners in whatever order you want?
Yeah, sure. So I'll go for one which probably quite a few people have gone for. I imagine a few listeners probably picked these out as well. But I've gone for Aston Villa. I think they've done pretty decent business. Got a Villa fan in our office, and he's been pretty smug, obviously following the result on the weekend. But generally speaking, I think they've done well. They've definitely kind of got to a point now where they've got an established spine with Martinez, goal. You've got Mings at the back of it. Then you've got Grealish, Barkley, McGinn in midfield, and Ollie Watkins, a proven goal scorer. You've got Wesley to come back. So I think I had them down as relegation, and so did you, if I'm right.
Yeah, we both did. We both had them down as relegation. They hadn't signed a player then at that point.
Yeah, fair point. So, now I think I'd probably have to revise that estimation and say that they'll probably sit about 14th or 15th. I can see them doing well this season with their recruitment. And this isn't just a knee-jerk reaction. This isn't a Robbie Savage-esque sort of, results-based punditry. I genuinely think that they've recruited well and they've done enough to definitely bump them up a few places in the table. Yes, yeah, so Villa are my first pick for winning in the transfer window, yeah.
Nice. Well, they were on my list as well. So we've got a match there. I completely agree with you. I think what they've done better than a lot of teams is actually improve their starting 11 rather than just sign in like 6-7 players that improve your squad, which is a way to do it. They've basically improved the spine, like you said. One issue for me is for years, even the Championship when they had Alan Hutton, a right back, they haven't had a right back, in my opinion, it's been decent for about 6 years. And Matty Cash was a good signing. I thought they'd overpaid for a couple of the players, but that's because they're proven in England. And like we just said with that stat a minute ago, you're playing a premium, aren't you, if you sign anybody, whether they're English or not, if they play in England. So I think they've been a little bit of a detriment to that. But for me, they're one of the more successful teams. And I think that Ollie Watkins and Martinez at either end will improve their chances of staying up. And I agree. I couldn't see them getting relegated if we did our table again. I've even seen some reports saying that Leeds and Aston Villa are going to battle it out together to finish in the top 10, which I think might be slightly pushing it, that two promoted teams finish in the top 10. But yeah, they're on my list. Another one on my list that most people have got, a common one, will be Everton. You just spoke about it then, obviously the players they've got in for a net spend, I think it was 65 million you said. I just think they're top talent. Obviously this isn't just hindsight with them winning four games in a row, but Alan has looked nearly as good signing as Rodriguez to me. Everyone talks about James, but Alan has been really good in midfield. Godfrey adds another option at the back, and I think if you want to drop Pickford, you've got an experienced keeper now that you can do that. So for me, Everton have just done really well, and Ancelotti's kind of finally got the squad and the players for the system that he wants.
On the subject of Everton, I was sent this by the infamous Richard Keys, former Sky Sports pundit. I was sent this quote by a friend at work, and I have to read it out because this is so just great. Classic Richard Keys. And, I think it will make a few viewers chuckle, so bear with me. Sorry, there may be a little bit of a noise here, sorry, as I grab my phone. But okay, here we go. Not everyone was convinced, though, with former Sky Sports broadcaster Richard Keys writing in his blog before the start of the season. Here we go. Everton, anything other than a top half finish would be a total failure. Having appointed Ancelotti, they need to back him, but I'm not convinced by James Rodriguez. If he was top draw, he wouldn't be signing for Everton, whoever was in charge. I wouldn't fancy him at Stoke on a wet Tuesday evening in November. Job playing Stoke, considering they're not in the same league. But he'll look great when the Toffees are 2-0 up at home. For Everton to make an impact, he's got to dominate games. If I was Ancelotti, I'd be going after Troy Deeney. That's what Everton need. Reed and Gray again. Deeney would be fantastic around the club, like Jagielka. He's a proper bloke.
Proper bloke? What does that even mean? Jagielka can't get a game at Sheffield United. What he means is he's English. And he likes a tackle. And basically, Richard Keys is obviously infamously known as one of the most sexist, racist presenters in Sky Sports. But yeah, that doesn't shock me that he said that. did it shock you when you read it?
No, but I did have a good laugh. And I can imagine him sitting there, like, gritting his teeth, thinking about how he acrimoniously left Sky. And he's probably seething now at the recent kind of like form of Everton. He's probably absolutely livid. But yeah, it made me thought it was worth sharing.
Well, whilst we're on the same topic, he also, I don't know if you saw this, but he did say to Andy Gray, because obviously they still work together, which is crazy, at BN Sports. He said after the 7-2 defeat of Liverpool that they should sign Sam Allardyce as a coach. Because obviously it's all well and good, these foreign coaches playing, it's not the exact quote, but these foreign coaches playing good football, but why can't you be more like an NFL or an NBA team that has a coach that looks after the defensive side? Sam Allardyce always sets his team up well defensively so he can help Liverpool stop conceding so many goals. And I was just there like, oh my God, you are so out of touch with football. It's unbelievable.
You would think for someone who watches so much football that he'd actually sound like someone who watches so much football. Like, is that ridiculous? You're asking your team to simultaneously do two very different things, which is near impossible, to press, to have a high press and to win the ball back within the first 5 to 8 seconds, the Gegen pressing that Klopp kind of like, you know, that's his philosophy, isn't it? Or you want to sit back, sit deep, you know, force the ball wide and defend balls in the air in your own 18-yard box. They're two absolutely different ways of playing football. What an absolute idiot.
So it's not been a good start to the season for old Keezy boy. Have you got any other teams on your winners list we haven't spoke about?
In terms of the transfer window, I've got one which is kind of semi-obvious, I suppose, but they have spent a lot and they have had some questionable results recently. But Chelsea, I think we touched on it at the beginning of the season when we were kind of making our predictions. I just think they filled quite a few gaps, and we haven't seen Werner, Ziyech, even Pulisic, you know, these players hit this form this season yet, but you'd think that they would at some point. And, you know, the only kind of caveat, the asterisk, so against this kind of a kind of praise for Chelsea is the fact that they've spent a shitload of money. And so if it doesn't go Lampard's way this season, I can see him getting the chop at some point. But I'm sure kind of Chelsea will probably get top four this season. You'd think so with that level of investment. But yeah, they're my final winner.
Yeah, they'd want more than top four, probably. But I agree with you. If that's not a minimum achievement, you don't get top four, then there's absolutely no way that Frank stays in the job. And if I'm honest, if you look at the way he sets the team up, and for me, the lack of pattern of play, the lack of like obvious style they've got, I just don't know how he's going to bed some of them players in. It's almost like he's just waiting for them all to be fit, so he can just put them all on the pitch and hope that they score enough goals between them to win games rather than have any setup. But I would agree that they're a winner, because when you go from the squad they had last year and you add some of the best talent in the world, you can't really be a loser, even if it takes another manager in a year's time to get the best out of them. And my last winner, which we're going to tie into our Leeds segment quickly, where I ask you a Leeds question, is the Mighty Whites, Leeds United. I put them in there just because, obviously, I'm a Leeds fan, so I'm biased. But also, the calibre of player we've attracted, and the money we've paid for some of them, full-blown internationals, I just think it's really impressive for a promoted team. We are probably still short of a number eight. Everybody knows that, who's a Leeds fan, but we've still got time to do that. But I just think they're a winner for me. For example, tonight, Germany and Spain play. We have the starting centre-back for Germany, the starting centre-back for Spain, and the number nine for Spain, all that play in our team that are all starting tonight for their countries. And if you'd have asked me, told me that 4 years ago, I would have laughed at you. So I put them as a winners list. And I just wanted to ask you your thoughts on the Sheffield United win and the Man City draw whilst we're talking about Leeds. If you watched either of the games, if you saw how we played against City and what your thoughts were on the overall start to the season.
I thought I caught the highlights, the extended highlights of the City game. And I did look out for the result when I saw, I think, just the goals from the Sheffield United game. It was interesting, the Pep. I'll focus more on the City game, if that's all right, just because...
Yeah, it's good.
It's interesting, the build-up. I know we spoke about it a couple of weeks ago, the kind of like the relationship between Bielsa and Pep Guardiola and this sort of subliminal sort of para-relation, tactical battle, how they set up. And it definitely unfolded that way throughout the game. I think both managers were very reactive to each other in terms of tactics. It was quite a cagey affair. And I think you set up exactly how you'd expect a team with your kind of strengths to set up. I remember saying a few weeks ago that if you weren't at the races, you'd get pumped. Unfortunately for you guys, like, the players all worked their socks off. And they kind of executed the game plan kind of implemented by Bielsa really well, and you were well worth your one all, you know, your point. Was it at the Etihad? It wasn't it?
No, it was at home, which is a shame, really, because obviously if there was fans in the stadium, it'd be a very different game for those Man City players.
That's one of the obviously the things that you kind of definitely have been taken away by the fans not being there. Is kind of you don't really get a sense of who's playing where when you're kind of catching the highlights.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
But yeah, just a quick one on the Sheffield United game. It was great, you know, for you to kind of get the 3 points there and to you to get that kind of the 4 points from two games, which I think I had you down as 1 point from there. So that really good kind of bit of momentum built there for the international break. And hopefully for your players who are away on international duty and playing tonight or later in the week will come back unscathed, buddy. But yeah, all good so far for you.
Yeah, definitely. And I hope England play three times. We're not going to do any chat really about internationals in this pod, but England play three times over the next week, and I just hope Calvin Phillips gets a start in the single pivot that he plays for Leeds, because that's where he'll shine for England. So I hope he gives that gets that chance. Let's go back to our winners and losers segment then. So on to losers now for the transfer market. I'll kick it off with an obvious one that we could not believe was going to happen. Burnley spent £0, so you have to be a loser for me. Their squad is one of the worst in the league. I had them to go down, and I think that prediction looks better now than it did 4 weeks ago when we predicted it, just because the fact their squad has not improved at all.
I think I had the mid to lower table, and I'm worried now. I'm worried. My credibility, my little credibility on this Leeds United podcast is gone out the window with this. But yeah, I think unless a Danny Welbeck on a free or some sort of can deal with the loan market with someone in the Football League, you know, I can't see them doing too much, which will significantly improve that squad or their fortunes at the moment. So yeah, I have them down as a loser for me as well.
Cool. Who else have you got on your list then? What's your next loser? Which team?
I feel like the Scum, we kind of talk about them too much, give them a bit too much airtime on this. I will just say, Dave, you know, I'll echo our thoughts from earlier, really. We kind of covered the failings of Man United earlier on. But yeah, it's this reactive sort of transfer policy. They've only spent £54 million, which is not a lot by their standards. A couple of players who aren't probably going to be ready to go into the first team. So there was no coherent strategy. Reactive, getting in a big name at the end of the window on a big salary. Yeah, not great for me. So United, they're my kind of one of my other downers as well.
Yeah, they're on my list as well. So we won't speak too much more about them. I agree with everything you said. They've still got huge holes for me. Some of the wages they're paying, some of their current players, they're just, their whole recruitment and retention policy is awful. And long may it continue. And my last loser is, I've gone with West Ham. Someone else who we joke about.
Someone all three.
We got the same. With West Ham, I know we mentioned no one wants to go there. If any Leeds fans don't follow other teams that much, pretty much they tried to bid for every centre-back who was English or played for an English club. Even on deadline day, they put in three loan moves, one for Twan Zabi from Man United, one from Rudiger from Chelsea, one for Tomori from Chelsea. And Tomori, they did an hour after Rudiger said no. So obviously they were just desperate. All three players, not even the clubs, all three players refused to even open talks with West Ham. No one wanted to go there. And I believe Wan Foyt as well from Spurs allegedly turned them down as well. So for me, they're a loser because they've not spent a lot of money. They've sold Philippe Anderson as well now, which is a bit of a weird one.
Was it to buy?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah,
Buy is kind of strange. Yeah, I don't know how.
It was a year loan, I think, and then to buy. They obviously kept Declan Rice, which they'd be buzzing about. But yeah, I think that says more about his ability and the fact that I think people want to see if West Ham could turn him into a centre back. But yeah, they're losers for me. Their squad's bad. We had them near the bottom of the league. I think I had them staying up by two or three places. I think you had similar, and I think they're a real candidate, I think they might be a real candidate to go down if they don't have a good start to the season.
Yeah, I think I'd agree there, mate. So I think that's the first time we've agreed on a winners and losers.
Yeah, it is, yeah. All the way through, so yeah, we're in cohesion. Let's move on to ups and downs then. This could be anything, player, club, story, whatever we want to go with. I went for all teams last podcast, so I've kind of changed that. So I'm going to start with my first up. I've gone with Mr. Dominic Calvert-Lewin. He's top scorer in the Premier League. His team have won 4 out of 4. He scored in every game, and he got his first England senior call-up as well, all in the same period of time. So for me, he's a huge up just because he's having the form of his life. He's still a young lad. He'll probably play for England, replacing Kane in one of the games where they want to rest Kane. So yeah, I just think amazing start for the lad. Impressed by the way he's played, and obviously a little bit linked to the fact his team top of the league. So yeah, that's my first one.
It's a good shout, and agree with you on that. I think, I hope I mentioned it in the podcast, in the initial, in our podcast, about how I feel like he'll have a good season. So I feel like I've got a little bit of credibility there for that.
Definitely.
Yeah, he's hit the ground running, isn't he? He's playing in a system which suits him, and he's just putting his chances away. And, you know, hopefully he kind of takes that form into the England national team. And I think he's a good alternative to Kane, but he does possess kind of like a few of Kane's traits. So he kind of like get interchange with him, but you could also kind of play with him, you could argue as well. So yeah, quality. Dominic Calvert-Lewin. How many goals has he got in the league so far? Is it 4 or 5?
Let's have a look. He's joint top scorer, sorry. He's got 6 goals. He's got 6 goals in 4 games. Over 13 shots. So his goal conversion rate is 46% with 69% shooting accuracy. He's joint top with Son. So yeah, doing really well.
Quality.
Cool. Do you want to go for your first up?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's kind of like a little bit of a similar success story, really. But I've gone for Arsenal's little chili, Bukayo Saka. he's had a obviously good start to the season. He's kind of picked up from where he left off, really, of that massive break we had, all 2 or 3 weeks, whatever it was. Yeah, I'm just happy for him. He seems like a real down-to-earth, level-headed guy, really humble. He's a good student of the game. He's always willing to learn. And yeah, I think Gareth Southgate's got a player who, I think he's picked him as a defender, from what I'm thinking, looking at the squad list. I think he is envisioning him playing at left-back or in a back three, or, you know, as a wing-back.
Wing-back, yeah.
Yeah, but I think in the future he'll kind of move further forward at the pitch, and you know, there's talk of him at Arsenal even being like a number 8 or going into a left side of a midfield 3 at some point. So he's got the ability, and I'm just really happy for him. Young chap, real good head on his shoulders, and yeah, hopefully he gets some minutes at some point over the international break.
Yeah, that is a good one as well, similar to Calvert-Lewin with the England call up. I think we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but with Mr. Chilwell maybe not playing, he actually could start quite a few minutes for England, I think. During lockdown, I think I even messaged you, didn't I, as well, about Saka, and said, I asked you kind of where you think his best position was, because I was clueless. And I think for Arsenal and England, if he could turn himself into a number 8, then he would potentially play more games for club and country.
He's a lot more press-resistant than what people think. He can play well in tight spaces. He likes to play in field. For a left-sided player, you would think that he's hugged the touchline, but he does kind of... We play this system where when the right-sided full-back or wing-back or midfield player has the ball, Arteta brings the left-sided player in to play as an 8 to kind of complement the midfield too. So he does play centrally a lot of the time for Arsenal anyway. So I feel like that kind of aspect of his game could definitely be something which England could utilise in the future, for sure.
If England play a 4-3-3 or play a 3-5-2, where do you see him, his best position for both those formations? Is it a wing-back in the 3-5-2 and then a winger in the 4-3-3? Or you think left-back currently in a 4-3-3 as well?
Yeah, it's a bit of a cop-out answer, really, but I think it depends on what type of opposition we play. If we're playing a team which are going to surrender possession to us and we're going to see a lot of the ball, I'd like to see him play, if we're playing a 4-3-3, I'd like to see him play in this kind of the left of that three, similar to what Angel Di Maria played a bit at United, but has been a massive success at PSG doing, and at Madrid as well, where he kind of is a mobile midfield player who cuts inside. I'd like to see Saka play in that position should we not, you know, be challenged for a majority of the pitch, pressured for like possession.
Yeah.
But if we're looking at a team, who are England actually playing in this run of fixtures, mate?
So we've got Wales in a friendly, on Thursday. And one of our two games is against Belgium. So they're a typical example of a team that want to have possession, right?
Yeah. So in that situation, I think I'd like to see him play left wing. I think you kind of give him the ball on a counter. I think he could do some damage on the break if you're going to kind of be hitting teams on the counter. So, yeah, I'd like to see him play. Just basically, I'd like to see him involved and maybe have some sort of positive impact. So depending on the opposition, either midfield or, you know, on the wing. But I think he'll be playing wing back, won't he, or left back, depending on how many we play at the back.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's just depending my
Depending on the system. Obviously, Sterling is out as well, so he might get some minutes on the left wing. Cool, another ups for me. We spoke about them already. Aston Villa, obviously their recent result, 7-2, very good result, but also they're unbeaten in the league and the cup. I thought they would really struggle. They signed better players than I thought they would, and they've started the league better off than I thought they would, so I could not include them really. But we spoke enough about them, so why don't we move on to your next up on your list?
My next up got Leeds. We mentioned it earlier. It was the fact that they got a better points all over the last two games than what I envisaged, particularly, obviously, the City game, which we've already kind of dissected. But, yeah, I just think, like, there's a positive atmosphere around your club. I think you're very fortunate to kind of come up, attract the players, and implement the style that you're currently playing with. Bielsa is obviously a massive instrumental part of that. But yeah, for me, I think this is like a nice kind of, this is more of a general positive, I suppose, really, that rather than just on the back of these last two results as well. But it seems to be kind of like a nice place to go and watch football at some point. So yeah, that would be good.
Definitely, yeah. I would put them on my list as well. And then in terms of, let's just quickly add on to that then. Leeds' next four games. No detail, just off the top of your head, what's a good points tally? We have Wolves at home, Aston Villa away, Leicester at home and Palace away. What is a good points tally for Leeds, would you say, in that little run?
Sorry, it was Wolves at home.
Wolves at home, Villa away.
Yeah.
Then Leicester at home.
Yeah.
And then Palace away. So two home, two away.
Okay.
Because there's the old adage, if you want to win your home games, obviously, but Leicester and Wolves are formidable teams.
I've got 4 or 5 points, and that's being conservative there, really. I think you've had a good run, and I think, you know, you'll be bedding in your new signings, and I feel like teams are going to slightly wise up to your approach. So I don't think you'll be getting as many wins as I probably would have put you down for maybe a couple of weeks ago. I think you'll beat Palace away. I think it will be a score draw, you know, at home to Wolves. And then the Villa and the Leicester games, I'm a little bit unsure about. I think Leicester at home, that could go either way, I think. I think you could win or lose that game. And at the Villa game, whose bubble's going to burst first? Leeds, you know, that's the question, isn't it? But I think 4 to 5 points. And I think Bielsa, I think as a supporter, you've got to be happy with that, haven't you not?
I don't know. It's hard to say. That's how high Bielsa has made our expectations as fans. He's such a great manager that we're just living in a bit of a dreamland at the moment.
Would you say then, in terms of a points haul from those fixtures, mate?
I'd want to beat Palace and Villa away, to be honest. And then you're talking about two home games, which you don't really want to lose two home games. So I don't know. I think realistic, you could win two games, so six at a minimum, as a realistic. But if you got eight out of that, so you went unbeaten, then wow, what a start that would be. But yeah, I'll say six at a minimum. And just another shout out as well with Sky. They've moved Leicester game and Wolves game both on Monday Night Football as well. So we're going to get Carragher and Neville doing the previews.
Yeah, I saw that. Pretty decent.
So that'd be good. And whilst on the topic of Leeds, my last ups is Mr. Patrick Bamford. He started way better than most Leeds fans thought. He's still got his number 9 shirt and it looks like he's going to hold on to that. We're going to kind of use Rodrigo as a number 10. Or we've kind of started to add a 3-5-2 into our list of formations a little bit on the ball. Rodrigo's kind of playing like a high 10. So just a shout out to Bamford for overachieving what we all thought and to holding on to a shirt after we spent 30 million on the striker. So he's my last ups. Have you got another ups or not?
Yeah, I think we don't want to keep repeating talking about the same teams and covering the same topics, but it was just Villa pumping Liverpool 7-2. The look on Klopp's face, utter disbelief. Some of the goals were comical as well, but I thought Villa, they forced those errors and they actually played some good football. Like John McGinn, Grealish, Barkley had free reign of Villa Park, it seemed. And Ollie Watkins will be a bit gutted not to come away with five goals because I think he actually missed the easier chances than what he than a couple
yeah, he
of.
Did.
But yeah, I just think that was an absolutely ridiculous result. And also, you've got to hand it to Spurs, you know, beating Man United at Old Trafford by such a ridiculous scoreline, and then only Spurs could get outdone by, you know, such another ridiculously, you know, high scoreline, you know, Villa obviously. Yeah. Liverpool.
Two hours later as well.
Yeah, that's it. Same day in everything. So, yeah, I just think Villa, we've given them quite a bit of love on this podcast today. So I want to refrain from, you know, saying too much more about them. But yeah, they've got to have a shout for that 7-2 thumping.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, unfortunately, I know a Man United fan pretty well. And he was so happy that Liverpool lost because it took the pressure off them for a while. And I know a few Leeds fans that were slightly gutted as well because we got so much praise for potentially nearly should have beaten Liverpool at home in the first game. Well, away for Leeds, obviously. And then that was like the standout result. And then for Villa to go beat them 7-2 kind of takes the shine off us losing 4-3. But yeah, big shout out to them. So let's move on to our downs then. I'll start off with someone we were just talking about. So I put Scum. I put Man United down there. They were just absolutely awful. I was disappointed in the sending off because it gave them an excuse. Because the way they were playing before that and in the Brighton game the week before, there's absolutely no way they'd have come away with anything from that Spurs game either way. So the red card, sorry, gave them a little bit of an excuse. But I put them on there just because they had a bad window. They looked awful against Brighton and snuck out a result. And they looked absolutely shocking at the back with some of the worst defending I've ever seen from Maguire and Luke Shaw against Spurs. And it probably could have been 10-1, to be honest. So yeah, they're my first one. Have you got a first person or team for downs?
Yeah, well, I've got something a little bit different, a little bit of a curveball here, but it's something which has been kind of going on social media since deadline day when it was reported by The Athletic that Gunnosaurus was being made redundant, being relieved of his duties.
Oh no, that's sad times.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of kind of like hate on the Arsenal board. Basically with the surrounding redundancies, yet the kind of willingness to invest in the team. But I don't really subscribe to this kind of like critique. I feel like, you know, ultimately, if you want to make the club strong financially, sustainable and employ more people and grow the club, you've got to be competitive on the field. At the moment, commercial deals, they're not what they were. You're not going to get the same, you know, revenue generated from the Premier League. You've got no fans in stadiums, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the quick way to get back into the big competitions, such as the Champions League, is to invest in your playing staff. Like, that's what you've got to do. Streamline resources. Of course, it's horrible. Redundancies. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not advocating that this is a good thing, that people are losing their jobs, such as Gunnosaurus. Apologies, I don't actually know his actual name. But, yeah, I think this is this kind of, like, reactive, knee-jerk response as fans that we see. We're kind of always kind of like vying for the underdog. But really, if teams continue to kind of have these bloated kind of like staff numbers during these very kind of serious times, then I think we're going to see the kind of down fortunes of the Premier League. And, you know, on this sort of topic, the kind of Mesut Ozil opportunistic offering to pay his wages, I just wish he had the same sort of understanding and kind of good grace when it came round to taking a voluntary pay cut, you know, a few months back. So, yeah, I just think the whole thing's a bit of a sham, really. And it's a bit of a joke. And, yeah, it's definitely not covered the club or lots of supporters in the same way.
No, I agree. Well, we slightly disagree on this. One of the things we do. I didn't think it was right for them to make that many people redundant just because the amount of wage they were saving is so little. I think it worked out to two players' wages for 3 weeks, which is not a lot. And I actually quite, I'm biased because I liked Ozil a lot for Real Madrid and think he's been a bit harshly treated at Arsenal, even though he's overpaid. I thought it was quite nice that he did that with the offering to pay the wages whilst he was still at the club. I know, obviously, he's no idiot and his team are no idiots. It's good for him in terms of social media and marketing presence, isn't it? That makes him look like a good person. I know that, but it's still a good idea. Have they actually decided if they're going to take him up on that offer, or are they just not? They're just going to not go.
I don't know, and I don't think I want to know, because I just think this whole situation now with Mesut Ozil, and yeah, it's just that it's a win-win for him as far as he's concerned and his team are concerned. But yeah, I don't know. Do you lose a bit of credibility as Arsenal Football Club if you take him up on that offer? Do you look a bit stingy? Do you look like you're kind of like looking for handouts? Do other players follow suit? Do you know what I mean? It sets a bit of precedent, doesn't it? But I just feel like, on the face of it, it's well played by Mesut Ozil, but I feel like I can see through the thinly veiled jab at the board.
It's lose-lose for Arsenal, like you said, though, with being win-win. Because if they don't take him up on the offer, they'll be seen as harsh because it costs them nothing. And if they do, it can, like you said, set a precedent. But I'm not sure. I did also hear that Ozil declined the pay cut and someone else did in the team, only because Arsenal refused to not... They said they'd only do a pay cut if you didn't make any staff redundant. And Arsenal said, we're going to still make staff redundant regardless of you took the pay cut. So apparently that's why he declined. I only read that in a story because Leeds players took a pay cut, but the rule, they said, we want half our wage for 6 months. You can pay it to us if we go up. But the rule is you have to pay all the staff for the whole of lockdown.
Yeah.
And apparently that's the same vibe that Ozil wanted and Arsenal declined. So I don't know if you can blame it all on him. I know he's a bit of a comedy villain when it comes to Arsenal. But
I'm not blaming it all on him, for sure. But definitely not. But I think he's just been very opportunistic at this moment in time. True. And I don't think you can, you know, from what I've heard in terms of the whole reluctance to take a pay cut, it was more on the grounds of he wasn't sure where the money was going to be spent, but he had assurances from, you know, the rest of the Arsenal, you know, first team squad. I think there was one or two other players who didn't take the same pay cut, but I don't know. It's one of those things where I think it's a very divisive subject, but at the moment, I think what he's done, he's come out of this on the surface very, very well, but I think there's definitely an element of almost, I don't know what the kind of word I'm looking for here, but yeah, the less said about this now, I think the better. I think I've ranted enough about this, but yeah,
I agree though that it's a hot topic at the moment, and he has been very opportunistic. I agree.
Yeah, manipulative, vindictive. I think he's been very opportunistic. But hey ho, that's my first down anyway.
But if you want to leave Arsenal on a free next year and play somewhere for 30 grand a week, we'll have you at Leeds, don't worry, Mesut, it's fine. So my next down is kind of I know that is football related, but not quite on the pitch. Well, it is on the pitch, not as team specific. It's the handball rule. And also it's Twitter, because I'm getting fed up of people blaming VAR, whether you like it or not, for the handball rule. The amount of people that are like, oh, VAR is a joke, that was never handball. It's like, no.
Separate things.
Yeah, the rule is the rule. I believe last week they've now put changes into the rules. They had a final opportunity to do so, which they did, which meant that Leeds didn't give a penalty away against Man City because it was the arm he was leaning on. He couldn't get it out of the way. So there has been a change, but the original rule was a joke. The amount of penalties we're seeing for handball is still a joke. I'm hoping that now improves as referees kind of understand the slight change in the rule. And I just hope people stop blaming VAR, because I understand that VAR is not perfect. The idea that Man United could get a penalty after the final whistle annoyed a lot of people. But that's just the way the VAR is going to have to be used. Whereas the handball rule is completely separate and people need to understand that. So I had to put that on my list.
That's a fair point, mate. I think, also the officials now, are they being asked to kind of check the monitors more? Is that right? Is that something that's come in since the start of the season?
Yeah, they've been asked to check the monitors more, but they were also asked to err on the side of give the penalty. Because it increases goals and it increases entertainment. So they're kind of really are caught in the middle a little bit. But the handball rule of it just touching the hand does not help referees in terms of the fans getting on their back, because you're just going to give all sorts of penalties, aren't you, in that situation.
Do you think the referees should be given a platform after the game to discuss their decisions or not?
I don't know if they'd want to. A lot of people think they would want to, because obviously they can show their point of view and calm people down. But how many times do you know what humans are like? How many times does a player come out with a stupid comment after the game that gets ripped for? I think a referee who's not as media trained and not used to it could potentially open up a can of worms.
Yeah.
But I understand the idea behind it. In the NBA, just to go off topic slightly, they have a 2-minute report where they basically look at all the referees' decisions in the last 2 minutes of a game, because that's where a lot of the action happens in basketball. And they kind of release what the referees should and shouldn't have done and why. They release that to the public and to the teams. Then the referees obviously will see that feedback. So they'll know from the official body which of their calls are right and wrong and why. And it gets written down in plain rules, which is quite a nice touch. So I understand being a bit more parity with fans and stuff about the decisions, but I don't know if interviewing is the way to go. But it could work. If Clattenburg was still a ref in the Premier League, he'd love it because he loves talking.
Yeah.
What about you? What are your thoughts on the handball rule and referees either giving a platform or the body coming out and talking about their decisions after the games?
Yeah, I think the handball rule has been improved. Like you said, it was ridiculous the first couple of weeks. We were seeing decisions being made based on, which is absolutely scandalous, wasn't it? You had to laugh at some of them. They were that bad.
Yeah, but they were really bad.
I think, the revision of the rule has been good. I think I kind of sit on the... I kind of sit in the camp which wants referees, wants officials to come out and discuss their decisions after the game. Because I think we don't kind of like give ourselves enough credit in terms of our degree of empathy for an official. And I feel like if they come in and give an interview after the game, I think that'll definitely humanise them a little bit. Because at the moment, Mike Dean, pantomime villain, as soon as the game kicks off. But if I were to listen to Mike Dean speak and let him justify his viewpoint for his decisions and why he did what he did on the pitch, I think I'd be a little bit more understanding. And I actually think a lot of people would, when fans are allowed back into stadiums, if these kind of referees have, the right media training and they do face up to whatever decisions, or whatever kind of actions that they've made, I think they would get a bit more slack from fan bases. I genuinely do.
Yeah, you could be right. I think they receive more slack than ever, right? Especially online now in this culture. So you could be right. I don't see any harm in trialing it at all, because the abuse level and some of the decisions are quite bad. So I agree with you that a minimum, a trial of something like that would make sense. Have you got any your next down then you want to discuss?
Yeah, this is something which has been going on for a kind of couple of weeks, really, isn't it? With the first of all, with the Phil Foden, Mason Greenwood, Iceland hotel girl debacle. But then since, we kind of learned that Sancho, Chilwell and Tammy Abraham have been caught out for Abraham's birthday whilst we're on England duty. And I think it's kind of one of these problems at the moment. We've got quite a young group of English players coming into the national side. And they're kind of, I want to say they've got too much too soon. And the discipline has been lacking, obviously. I heard today that Harry Kane led a meeting. The charismatic Harry Kane sat everyone down and basically just kind of drove home what's expected of England players. But I do just feel like for this to happen a couple of weeks ago, you would think, these are bright young lads. These are people who have kind of like been in the public eye for the last couple of years. Have a little bit of common sense about you. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just a bit ridiculous. It's disrespectful to not just the immediate players, but also the amount of people who would love to put on that shirt. And they are essentially, playing Russian roulette with their health and also that of their teammates and the England staff. So, yeah, a bit of a downer for me. Obviously, the media are going to sensationalise it a little bit and make it worse than it is. But ultimately, they've broke regulations, put in place safeguards in order to keep people as safe and healthy as possible. And it's the second time in a number of months. And it's just a bit of a joke, really, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people don't realise that these players do get paid when they go away as well. So England will have their own protocols that they've broken. So they've broken their employers, even if it's just for the week they're there, their employers, and people don't want to see it like that. They've broken their rules and regs. But obviously, they've broken the law as well. And people kind of gloss over the fact that it's a law. They think it's kind of just this, I don't know, unwritten rule almost, but it's actually a law. So between them, obviously the Foden scenario last time, and obviously Jack Grealish, who was drink driving and at a party in lockdown, who were all England players, and Kyle Walker, sorry, who did the same, an England player as well. Yeah. I don't think it's kind of put the national team in a good state. And I think of it is to do with the youth. But I think a lot of it is actually to do with, unfortunately, a little bit more about even general population. We've seen so many rule breaks across the whole country during this time, and us as a nation have really struggled to follow the rules in a small percentage. And I think a small percentage of the squad are kind of representing a small percentage of society, really. And they should know better, especially with how much they get paid and being role models. And I just think, obviously, we don't know how the meeting went, but Southgate approached them last night as well. Came today, like you said. And I just hope that they kind of listen. And I know one of the reasons the Leeds fans, we all want to see Calvin Phillips in the squad, is because he's such a good, kind, hardworking family man. And I think we've got a lot of players like that in the squad, Harry Kane included. So I think there's a good balance, but I just think that this really needs to stop. And in my opinion, I don't think those three players should play in those three games.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't think you should include them in the next squad either, just because you haven't included Greenwood and Foden in this squad. So if that's your rule that they don't play in this time and they have to miss a go next time and give someone else a chance, I think we should follow that rule. I know, yeah. Tammy's a bit different because apparently it's a surprise party. But obviously, he then didn't leave or ask people to leave or enforce the rule of six. He still stayed. So he can say he didn't know about it being organised, but he chose to not end it. So that'd be my views on that, to be honest, mate.
Nice.
And it's good for Saka because he can play left back.
Yeah, that's it. Maybe we should get more players going out bloody partying. Well, Arsenal and Leeds players in the starting 11 for the World Cup and the Euros.
Paddy Bamford, let's go up top.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, I'm going to go on to my last downs then. I've got Sheffield United down here. I wanted to put one team in this little list and a team we kind of haven't spoken about as much in this podcast as some of the others. Obviously, they're winless. There's arguments that they've been worked out with their overlapping fullbacks. I'm not sure if it's that. I just think it's more of a loss of momentum. They've still got a lot of League One and Championship players. So I think it's more of losing their momentum rather than the tactics being worked out. I just think that they were kind of overplaying themselves last season. They're also goalless until the 80-odd minute at the Emirates when you guys started to let McGoldrick have a free shot of the goal. But overall, they don't know that they're going to score a lot of goals. I know they've signed Rian Brewster now, which is a real positive for them. But I had them finishing mid-table. I think you had them finishing lower mid-table in your predictions. And at the moment, if they don't start doing well, I think they could be a real relegation candidate. They've dropped from like 8-1 odds to second favourite to go down. And I know that's kind of fluid because of obviously just current results. But I think if they're not careful and don't start increasing goals, that could be them. And they've also, in their next five games, they've got Chelsea, Man City and Liverpool, two of which are away. I know they've got Fulham mixed in there as well, who are obviously a must win. But yeah, Liverpool, Man City and Chelsea in your next few, I just struggle to think that come November time, they're not going to be in the bottom three, and whether they'll need to change the manager or not, we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, they were my last down.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything you said there, mate. Like, I kind of thought this was going to be the case in terms of that kind of loss of momentum. They obviously didn't invest heavily. I know they just brought in Rian Brewster. But again, Liverpool getting £23.5 million for Rian Brewster. That's absolutely ridiculous money, in my opinion. But yeah, I think that Sheffield, rightly so, they're going to be involved in a bit of a relegation scrap if they don't sort of get, come November time, those fixtures you just mentioned, I don't see them getting, other than the Fulham game, I don't see them getting a point, if I'm honest, at the moment. They look quite flat. They don't look like they've got much imagination. I think the underlapping fullback kind of approach, teams have wised up to that. And I completely kind of agree with what you've said there, buddy. I don't kind of think it bodes well for them this season. Can I see Chris Wilder? being kind of relieved of his duties. I'm not too sure. I think he's done so well given the kind of financial constraints he's had at that club since taking over. I think they'll stick with him. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me come March, April time, there was some squeaky bumps up at Bramall Lane.
Yeah, I agree. The only thing that made me thought about that in terms of Wilder was the ownership. There's been a lot of issues between who owns the club, two people trying to own them from the Middle East. And I don't know if they'll be a bit more trigger happy than the average owner if things go wrong, just because how much money's at stake. But they've got a slightly favourable December. So I think they're going to be in trouble in November, and then December, they need to get the points on board, or else they could be real in a real bad place come January. Yeah. Have you got any more on your downs, or have we covered it all now?
Yeah, I think we've kind of covered them throughout. Again, it was just the freak results of the weekend, really, the losing sides, the United and Liverpool. Obviously, United, you've come to expect some sort of error-prone defending, but Liverpool, it was a bizarre result. The nature of some of the goals were absolutely ridiculous, but also it's this high line that they've been so insistent on playing. And I did say a few weeks back that Liverpool, how high they play this line, I'm not going to say that I envisaged there's going to be a massive 7-2 pump in by Aston Villa, but it was almost, and I'm sure, you know, Man United fans of old will kind of agree with me on this a little bit. I feel like for years after Fergie's like 2008-2009 United side, Man United still had this fear factor where, regardless of who was playing, if you went to Old Trafford or even you played United anywhere, they had this element of afforded respect and you wouldn't go at them because you thought, oh, they're going to pick us apart on the break. They're too good playing out from the back. They can go long. Yeah. And I feel like Liverpool have had that, but they've got a bit more of a glass jaw than what people think. And it's taken a brave, vibrant Villa side to go at them and show, you know, the Premier League and Europe that, you know, this side isn't indestructible. They've got fragilities. And let's be honest, Ollie Watkins, you know, he's come from Brentford. I know he's a good player, but he's still relatively unproven in terms of the Premier League level. And they absolutely slaughtered them, like, defensively. And you could argue even before kind of like goals 3, 4 and 5 went in, Liverpool were just not at the races at all. So, yeah, they were my third down for me. But I think that was a bit overdue. But I'm sure Anfield will still be a fortress. But I can see a few more of these sorts of results taking place this season. Not just Liverpool, but most of the top six. I think at some point or another, we'll be on the end of a unfavourable thumping.
Yeah, I agree. I hope Leeds give out a couple of those thumpings, especially in Manchester. But yeah, no, I agree with everything you said there. Leeds and Villa obviously put 10 goals past Liverpool in the first three games of the season. So there's obviously frailties there. And I think away from home, I agree, they might have some bad results. Cool. But let's go on to our last quickfire topic then. Best upcoming games. We're only going to review for match day 5 because there's a bit of a gap because of the international duty. So we're just going to review for 1 week coming forward. So for me, I think we both have this on our list. So we'll talk about it first. I had Leeds versus Wolves, which is on Monday Night Football, 8 o'clock kickoff on the 19th. I just think this is a very exciting game, obviously. Depends on who you listen to. Leeds want to be like Wolves. They'll just say they want to stay up, but you could tell that Bielsa and the way we play and the way we've started, that he'll want to be more like a Wolves, which obviously finished 9th, I think, in their first season back. Obviously, both foreign managers that kind of get lumped with the same style, but they actually don't play the same style. They both want to keep the ball and they both like to overload out wide. But obviously, we press really high, whereas Wolves like to drop back real deep and hit people on the counter. So I think it's going to be a real exciting game. We could see some more goals and it'll kind of be maybe the first test to see, are we truly a top 10, top 8 side, rather than obviously because we've had hard games and easy games. So I'm really looking forward to it.
I agree, mate. I think, echoing what you've just said there, I think we'll see both teams relatively unshackled for this. It'll be a bit of a slugfest. I'm excited to see kind of how both teams match up here and to see if, you know, these sort of these kind of risky signings that Wolves have made, if they kind of hit the ground running during this game. But yeah, I think it's going to be interesting viewing. tactically, you're right, they play very different. I think, like you said, people see the possession-based philosophies of both foreign managers and they just assume that they play identical brands of football. But you're right, they're very different. And one's definitely more proactive and possession-based more than the other, which, you know, that kind of switch in terms of attack and defence is very different. But yeah, I think Leeds are probably... I'm going to go for a score draw on that, mate. I'm going to go 3-3.
Oh, wow. Yeah, if we do a prediction for each of our games, that'd be a good way to add it. So I'm more confident about this than I am Villa away and Leicester at home. I really rate Leicester. I probably overrate them. Maybe it's just the story. So I think that'll be a tougher game than this. So I can see Leeds winning 3-2. Pablo Hernandez should be back, and Rafinha, new signing, will also be involved. So we've really improved our squad there just by our best player from last year and our best, well, arguably our best signing this year. So I'm going to go with a 3-2 win. But I could quite easily see it being a score draw if we don't take our chances. Next game on my list, I've gone for an Arsenal game. Not just because you're here, but because they're quite good to watch. I've gone for Man City Arsenal on the Saturday, I believe, 17th. 5:30 kickoff, so that one's on Sky as well. I'm just excited to see how Man City bounce back from obviously two games where they've dropped points. Arsenal kind of they had not the greatest performance at Anfield, but aside from that, since Arteta's came in, you've been pretty dominant. And obviously, he used to be Pep's assistant, so he knows a lot about Man City. So I'm excited just to see how this game goes. And if I had to give a prediction out, I'm afraid to say I can just see it being a 2-1 Man City win, unfortunately.
Cool. Okay. Not going to get personal with this, but I now think it's going to beat Liverpool 5-1. with the Arsenal trip to City, I think you kind of drew upon it a bit there. Obviously, Guardiola, Arteta, got good working relationship, know each other inside out. I think Arteta, he knows how to set up against City. And I don't think their squad's changed all that much. Especially in terms of kind of like attack threat. So I think we'll be wised up to the kind of the strengths of Man City. I'm going to be optimistic and go for a 2-1 win. We won earlier, what was it, 2-0?
2-0, yeah.
On the way to winning the FA Cup. And I just feel like, if he's in the side and he hits the ground running, I think he'll be a good shield in midfield, but also given that distribution. And Gabriel at the back, he's been good since coming in. So, yeah, I'm going to be optimistic and say 2-1 to the Arse.
Do you think he'll start, Partey, or you just...
Probably not. It depends. Yeah, it depends how he comes back from international duty. There's quite a few different kind of factors, but I can see this being a game for Xhaka and Elneny, and then Partey maybe coming in. But I don't envisage a tactical change in terms of formation. I think we'll stick with this 3-4-3 or whatever variation in and out of possession you want to call it. But I can see Partey coming in for the last half an hour or so, but I don't see him starting.
Yeah, I think it'll be a fun game. And if City didn't sign Diaz and hadn't not won their last two games, I probably would have gone with the draw.
Yeah,
but I just can't see them dropping points three games in a row, really. But it'll be a fun watch, that's for sure. Have you got another game on your list you want to talk about quickly?
I do, yeah. So it's the Merseyside Derby, which I think, big shout, it could, at the moment, at the time of the podcast, and any other caveat I can insert there, could be one of the games of the season. And I think I'm going to put my neck on the line here. This could be the end of the Everton hoodoo against Liverpool, because I know they've got a pretty poor record, haven't they, against Liverpool and Merseyside derbies.
Yeah, especially with Klopp. I've never they won one yet.
They've absolutely battered him, haven't they, in terms of like head-to-heads. But I do think that now's a good time as ever for Everton. Obviously, we kind of touched upon their form, the free scoring Calvert-Lewin, the balance. What strikes me is their balance in midfield. You've got Alan, you've got Gomez, you've got obviously Decore, and then you've got James kind of pulling the strings. They're a lot more balanced than they were last season, just through that kind of midfield surgery. Ancelotti's got everyone, arguably, he wanted in. He got them in and he's got them playing really well. But Liverpool are also going to want to, you know, provide a big response after the Villa game. So that's why I think it could be a really good game. It could be aggressive, both teams going at each other to prove a point, a statement of intent. And yeah, I think an early shout for potentially one of the games of the season.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree with you as well on Everton. I really fancy them to get something in this game. I don't see them losing the game. It's at Goodison Park. I know it doesn't mean the same anymore. But yeah, it's not at Anfield, which is a bit more of a hoodoo. So whether that's more of a mental thing for some of the players that have been there a while, I'm not sure. But yeah, I fancy Everton as well. I agree completely with what you said on the midfield. And the goalkeeper battle is interesting to me. Obviously, Alisson's out for 6 weeks, so we're going to see Adrian in goal again. Who was an absolute travesty against Aston Villa. And obviously, we've mentioned it earlier in the podcast about them signing Olsen on loan. So who do they start? Obviously, there's calls for Pickford to not play for England in every game to try and trial someone else out. So whether he gets dropped by his country and his club in the same week, that'd be a bit of a battle, but I'm not sure. But yeah, I'm going to go with Everton as well. In terms of the score, we're predicting a lot of goals in this podcast with the 3-2 leads and the 3-3 leads in the other game. But I'm going to go 3-2 Everton.
I'll go 2-1 to the Blues.
I'm going to go 3-2. But I wouldn't shock me if it was a 3-1 win either, the way that they're playing. I think James is going to have a great game, but we'll have to see. And the last one on my list, I've gone for one a bit outside there because we did agree on a lot of the games because we're doing 1 week's worth of games. So I've gone for the Sunday game. I've gone for Spurs versus West Ham. People always say, oh, why have I gone for this? West Ham are awful, which they are. But I want to see Gareth Bale in the Premier League, and I think he's due to be fit, hopefully, and involved in this game. So if I can see Son, Kane and Gareth Bale in a game all playing together, who I now think are the best three forward in the Premier League, Liverpool fans will hate me. I think that's the best front three when fit now in the Premier League. Obviously, they're not played together, so not in terms of actual rotations and stuff. But on paper, that's the best front three for me. So I'm just looking forward to seeing that. Jose's obviously started quite well with his time at Spurs. That's a game they need to win, and they're scoring goals for fun. They've scored five, seven and six in three different games already this season, Europa League and Premier League. So I'm going to go for a 4-1 Spurs win in that one. With Bale scoring off the bench, how about that?
Optimistic, you love a bit of G Bale. Yeah, mate, I can see that being an all right game. West Ham will obviously be on a bit of a high after their decent result against Leicester as well. But yeah, I think the stage is set for Gareth Bale to score. Remember, was it a few years back when he was his last season at Spurs when they were under ABB? He hit like a 35 yarder in stopping. Against West Ham, didn't he? Remember that?
Yeah, at Upton Park as well, I think, wasn't it? Because they hadn't moved then. And he's picked it up in midfield, got fouled, got straight back up, ran through and just absolutely pinged it.
There was that of him and ABB, and it was like the meme was, it's like, oh yeah, we've got fajitas for tea. And just like loving each other, screaming. It's quite funny.
Yeah, he's grabbing his face, I think, isn't he? When he's doing it. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that. And I agree, we didn't touch on it much and we haven't got time to, but West Ham's shocking win over Leicester for me was actually probably definitely more surprising than the Spurs result because I don't rate Man United. But it was up there for one of the shocks of the season for me. So I'd be interested to see if it was a fluke or have West Ham found something. Also, Moyes will be back now. So maybe Moyes being at home was the reason West Ham were winning. So we'll have to see if they go back to losing now. Have you got another game on your list, or is that it?
That's it, buddy. So I had the Merseyside derby, City Arsenal, and then the Wolves Leeds game. So yeah, cool. Again, great minds think alike. But sure, hell of a lot of goals in all three of those games, and yeah, hopefully they're all decent.
Yeah, definitely. There's some good games overall that weekend, and we're seeing crazy amounts of goals. So I imagine match of the day is going to be a highlight again. The plan with this pod is we'll get back to the normal schedule after international duty. So we'll cover match day 6 and 7 preview in our next pod. But yeah, I think all that to say is enjoy the football, mate. And thanks again for joining me.
No worries. Thank you for having me on again, buddy. You enjoy the international break. I know you're one of the minority that actually enjoy internationals, whereas I think the majority of us just can't wait for the Prem to resume. But it should be good. Hopefully, the Leeds boys do you proud in terms of representing their countries. And it's been good. I think we've discussed quite a few, decent topics this week. It's been a little bit different than usual, hasn't it? Obviously, with the kind of deadline day and the crazy results and stuff. It's been good. And yeah, thanks again for having me on.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, next time there'll be we'll add in a different segment as well to mix things up, because obviously there's no more transfer news, so we'll come up with an idea. And I'll speak to you in a few weeks. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you very much. Take care.